finished explaining, I had usually forgotten my question. Nonetheless, I was entirely fascinated by his passion for words and by how much he knew. In my uncle's library, I always headed straight for the collected Reader's Digest, which I liked for two reasons. They were small, and they arrived in the mail every month from America. I did not know a word of English, yet I enjoyed studying the child-sized magazines from cover to cover, trying to figure out what the stories were about. I always made sure to put them back in the exact order in which I'd found them, for fear of losing the privilege of browsing in my uncle's library. Years later, after we moved to America, my father bought me my own subscription to Reader's Digest, an event that remains the high point of my life in junior high. Aunt Sedire and Uncle Abdullah now live near my parents in Southern California. Even though their condominium has only a tiny garden, they have managed to cultivate an enviable cornucopia of figs, pomegranates, sweet lemons, and herbs. My aunt is still a wonderful cook, and no visit to Southern California would ever be complete without her lentil saffron rice, her eggplant stew with beef shank, or her signature oven-cooked salmon stuffed with homegrown herbs. My sweet Aunt Miss still delivers her kind compliments, but nowadays she tells me what a good mother I am, and I tell her what a compliment that is coming from her. Uncle Abdullah is a translator, a job that allows him to surround himself with his beloved words. His passions, however, have broadened to include computers, which he discovered when he was well into his 70s. This means that whenever my husband, the software engineer, visits Southern California, he spends hours with Abdullah trying to retrieve lost and deleted files. "I don't know how it happened," my uncle always says. My husband reminds him, "When the computer asks, 'Are you sure you want to delete this file?' just say no." "It doesn't ask me," my uncle always replies. "They just disappear." My aunt and uncle have four sons, Muhammad, Mahmoud, Mehdi, and Mehrdad, all of whom are married with children of their own. Even though my father considers all his nieces and nephews to be his own kids, he is particularly close to his sister Sedire's children because they live near us in Abadan, allowing my father the pleasure of watching his nephews grow up. He loves recounting endless stories about each one, emphasizing their unusual intelligence, wit, and charm. "We've already heard that one," we tell him, but my father never hears us. For in recounting his stories, he relives the sweetest moments of his life. In return, his nephews adore him. When my parents want to go on a great vacation, they visit Mehdi, who is a professor in Austria. "Mehdi knows how to show us a good time," they always say. When they want any kind of medical advice, they ask Mahmoud, the orthopedic surgeon, the best surgeon ever, according to them. When my parents want hospitality, they visit Muhammad, whose kindness and generosity remind my parents of their lives back in Abadan. And for entertainment, they always visit Mehrdad, who is their unofficial third son and the proud father of the only two red-headed members of our family. "His kids could be models," boast my parents. After the Iranian Revolution, my father, unable to find a job in Southern California, had stayed with Mehdi's family while working in Northern California. Mehdi's oldest son, Daryush, and Daryush's younger brother, Ryan, had moved into one room so that my father could have his own room. 20 years later, my husband and I cleared out a room in our house so Daryush could stay with us while working as an intern at a nearby computer firm. "I guess it's payback time," he said when he arrived. We all laughed, knowing that the thread of kindness and generosity in our family has no beginning and no end. "Just make sure you have room in your house," I told Daryush. "Someday my kids will be coming." When Daryush's grandmother Sedire was a young girl, she was, according to my father, the smartest one of all. Times being what they were, Sedire was not allowed to pursue her education past sixth grade and was married shortly thereafter. All her brothers became engineers and doctors. My father found this a huge injustice. He always told me that if his sister had been able to pursue her education, she would have become the best doctor of them all, for not only was she smart, she was resourceful as well. He loved to tell the story of how one year all the family's chickens were dying and nobody knew why. Sidire was determined to find the cause. She began to observe the chickens closely and noticed that they appeared to have trouble swallowing. She then performed an autopsy on one of the dead chicks and discovered a tumor in its throat. She then took each chick that was still alive, made a small incision in its throat, removed the tumor, and sewed it back up. They all survived. Whenever my father told me this story, his eyes welled up. "What an injustice to deny a mind like that an education," he always said, his voice getting smaller and smaller before he exclaimed, "And you, Firuze, you will go to a university." My father could not change the past, but the past had most certainly changed him. "I don't care if you do nothing with your college diploma, but you will have one," he adamantly declared. It was payback time for my father, whose daughter was destined to claim the education denied his sister. My oldest paternal uncle, Mohammed, did become a doctor, the first in the family. As a young doctor, he supported his younger siblings, enabling them to continue their education. My amu had a successful practice in Ahvaz and enjoyed a life of luxury up until the Iranian Revolution. He and his family fled to America in 1980 with just a few belongings. Mohammed's Iranian medical license did not allow him to practice in America, so he had to take both English and medical courses and pass the necessary exams. At 58, an age when most doctors are thinking of retirement, my uncle had to spend a year as an intern, the oldest one in the hospital. After completing his education, he set up a practice in Southern California, joining the ranks of other hard-working immigrants pursuing the American dream. Eventually, he managed to create a lifestyle somewhat like the one he left in Iran. He even bought a Mercedes, which, unlike his Mercedes in Iran, he has to drive himself. My father always says that his brother made the family proud twice, once as a young man when he became a doctor, and once as a not-so-young man when he became a doctor for the second time. Uncle Mohammed is our family's symbol of perseverance. All of my amme and amu live within 15 minutes of one another and manage to get together for every possible occasion, from birthdays to that long-standing favorite, the Miss America pageant. My amu Mohammed recently turned 80, an event that the family celebrated with a Hawaiian-themed birthday party. 70 family members spanning 3 generations attended. Uncle Mohammed gave a speech and announced that he would never retire. The family cheered. As boring as graduation ceremonies are, my relatives attend every one, rejoicing in the academic accomplishments of the children and grandchildren. Nobody understands the graduation speeches, but everyone goes to clap and cheer. Like all Iranians, we consider academics to be of the utmost importance. Almost every child in my extended family has attended college, a record that brings tears of pride and joy to the eyes of the older generation, a record that we hope to continue. My relatives also attend one another's housewarming parties, New Year celebrations, and baby showers, all en masse. Recently, my pisar amu, the son of my father's brother, moved into an apartment near UCLA to begin dental school. His father threw him a housewarming party, and 50 members of the family showed up to celebrate in his tiny apartment. "It was great," my father said. My father and his siblings drive one another to doctor's appointments and pick one another up from the airport. If one goes for a checkup, they all call for the results. They know which one of them has high blood pressure and which one is allergic to dairy products. They know one another's favorite foods and often use the knowledge to lure one another for visits. "Kazem, I just made rice pudding," is my Aunt Sedira's way of inviting my father over. His other sister, Fatime, has her own equally effective siren song, "Kazem, the mulberries are ripe." Together, my relatives form an alliance that represents a genuine and enduring love of family, one that sustains them through difficulties and gives them reasons to celebrate during good times. My father and his siblings have even purchased burial plots together, because as my father told me, we never want to be separated. Uncle Muhammad, the oldest doctor, purchased a plot high on the hill with a view of the Pacific Ocean. I've always wanted an ocean view, he says. Before I married François, I told him that I came with a tribe, a free set of Ginsu knives with every purchase, so to speak. François said he loved tribes, especially mine. Now, whenever we visit my relatives, all of whom dote on my husband, I realize that he didn't marry me despite my tribe. He married me because of them. Without my relatives, I am but a thread. Together, we form a colorful and elaborate Persian carpet. Me and Bob Hope. The great American philosopher Dr. Seuss once wrote about a fellow named the Grinch, who for some mysterious reason did not enjoy Christmas. Dr. Seuss tried to delve deep into the unfestive mind of this enigmatic creature in order to find a possible reason for his lack of Christmas spirit. It could be his head wasn't screwed on just right. It could be, perhaps, that his shoes were too tight. These are fine explanations, but to me, the obvious answer was overlooked. Perhaps the Grinch was, like me, a Muslim, someone who was left out of all Christmas festivities. The problem with the religious explanation is obvious. Nothing rhymes with Muslim. At least if you're Jewish, you can feel bluish during Christmas, but with Muslim, you're just stuck. When I lived in Iran, the country was predominantly, but not entirely, Muslim. Iranian Jews and Christians worshipped in peace. My family and I were secular Muslims, like most of the population. My parents' idea of being religious consisted of donating a part of their income to the poor and not eating ham. The only women who chose to cover themselves head to toe with a chador were either older women or villagers. In the cities, Iranian women preferred to dress like Jackie Kennedy or Elizabeth Taylor. In school, one of the subjects we studied was religion. We learned not only about Islam, but also about Judaism, Christianity, and Buddhism. We were taught to practice Islam, but to respect all religions. Knowledge of Islam was mandatory for all Muslim students. Its practice was not. The Christian and Jewish children at my school were exempt from religious studies, a fact that caused much envy among the rest of us. When we moved to America, I discovered that school was much more fun here. There was less homework, no endless math drills, and no memorization of famous poems. I loved my teacher, Mrs. Sandberg. I loved Girl Scouts, the Whittier Public Library, and Butterfinger candy bars. I loved Halloween, the Brady Bunch, and free toys in cereal boxes. It seemed to me that life in America was one long series of festivities, all of them celebrated with merriment and chocolate. The laughter, however, stopped when we reached Christmas. All of a sudden, everyone was having a party, and I was not invited. In Iran, the biggest holiday is Nowruz, New Year's Day. Since it is a secular holiday, Nowruz is celebrated by the entire country, as Thanksgiving is in the United States. It always begins on the first day of spring at the exact moment of the equinox. This means that every year Nowruz begins at a different time. One year it might be March 21st at 5:32 a.m., while the next year it might occur on March 20th at 11:54 p.m. Every Iranian knows the exact moment the jubilation begins. The festivities are preceded by weeks of preparation. Everyone thoroughly cleans his house, buys or makes new clothes, and bakes traditional pastries. A ceremonial setting called a haftsin, which consists of seven symbols beginning with the sound S, is displayed along with other meaningful objects like a mirror, colored eggs, and goldfish in a bowl. The objects represent health, renewal, prosperity, fertility, and the usual universal hopes shared by people at any New Year's celebration. Unlike the traditional American New Year's wishes, however, the Persian New Year holds no symbols of hope representing losing 10 pounds or getting in shape. For Nowruz, most businesses close and the streets are deserted. For 12 days after the equinox, people visit relatives and friends, always starting with the eldest. Once all the elders have been visited, they in turn visit the younger members of the family. At every house, a tray of homemade sweets is offered, along with wishes for the new year. Children receive money, always in the form of brand new bills. I assume that since the wave of immigration after 1980, banks in America have noticed a sudden increase in demand for crisp bills in the month of March. But when we moved to America in 1972, Nowruz lost all its meaning. No longer did we feel the excitement building toward the big day. No longer did we see people cleaning their drapes, buying new clothes, or sweeping their yards spotless. No longer did we prepare for an onslaught of visitors. Gone were the smells of pastries coming from every kitchen. Gone were the purple hyacinths that decorated every house. Gone were the strangers wishing us Nowruz Mubarak, Happy New Year. Gone was the excitement in the air. In America, we have tried our best to celebrate Nowruz, but it's a challenge. Since it's not an American holiday, everyone is either at work or in school. It's hard to get in the mood when your national holiday falls somewhere between soccer practice and the dentist appointment. However, now that there are more Iranian immigrants in America, it is becoming far more enjoyable to celebrate Nowruz. I'm sure that Macy's Nowruz sale is not too far behind. In America, Christmas is the king of all holidays. To be left out of Christmas is the ultimate minority experience. As an adolescent, I learned to commiserate with my Jewish friends. Together, we talked about how we couldn't wait for December 26th, how we hated hearing Christmas songs everywhere, and how we wished that our mothers would just once bake us Christmas cookies. Although I enjoyed kvetching with my Jewish friends, I was not convinced that they could thoroughly feel my pain. They, after all, had Hanukkah, which, even though it's completely different from Christmas, still involves food, clothing, presents, and light. At my house, December could have just as easily been August, since there was absolutely no sign of any festivities. Christmas vacation was a long, boring holiday. In Iran, whenever we had free time, we got together with relatives. In America, whenever we had free time, we watched television. Christmas for us meant an evening spent with Bob Hope, John Denver, Sonny and Cher, Tony Orlando and Don, and any other celebrity who managed to have a Christmas special. We weren't picky. If it was on, we watched. My parents, however, had a particular fondness for the annual Bob Hope Christmas specials with frequent guest star Brooke Shields. They didn't understand any of Bob's jokes, but my father laughed along with the laugh tracks. Then my father would ask, "Inchigoft? What did he say?" And that was how I spent Christmas Eve, translating Bob Hope's jokes into Persian, jokes that my parents didn't understand in any language. Of course, for my father, Bob Hope was more than just a comedian. He was a dignified older man who wore sharp suits, had great posture, and managed to be witty without ever getting nervous. I think that secretly, my father wanted to be Bob Hope. My mother thought Brooke Shields, in the dozen different outfits she wore for each show, was the embodiment of perfection. I could not understand why Brooke, who is the same age as I am, never went through an awkward adolescent stage. I wished I could be Brooke Shields. So did my mom. In between all the song and dance numbers, we watched endless commercials for all the wonderful gifts that we were not going to receive, and made plans for the after-Christmas sales, a celebration that unites all religions. During the month of December, people constantly wished us Merry Christmas in that automatic way. If we said that we didn't celebrate Christmas, we received a cheery Happy Hanukkah. Call us Scrooge, but we didn't celebrate that one either. Then what do you celebrate? We were always asked. Nothing, we'd say. What are you? Muslim. A few brave souls inquired further, usually academic types or residents of Berkeley. The average citizen, however, smiled and said, "Oh," and left. When I married a Catholic, I became a card-carrying member of the Christmas Club. Now, every December, my children and I drag a tree into our house, leaving a trail of pine needles should the tree need to find its way back. We decorate the tree with ornaments that take up half of our closet space, eat Christmas cookies that help us grow in both spirit and girth, and read Christmas stories that leave my children asking